This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Grisham has sold more novels for adults than any other living writer. With his new book, The Summons, he returns to the genre that made him famous, the legal thriller. His previous two books were an autobiographical novel and a novella. His best-selling legal thrillers include The Firm, The Client, The Pelican Brief, The Runaway Jury, and A Time to Kill. Even if you haven't read any of his books, you've probably seen some of their film adaptations. Before he was the king of the legal thriller, he was what he describes as a street lawyer in a suburb of Memphis. When I spoke with Grisham in 1997, he said that his first novel, A Time to Kill, was his most autobiographical thriller. I read him an excerpt of the introduction that he'd written for a new edition. One day I stumbled upon a horrible trial in which a young girl testified against the man who brutally raped her. It was a gut-wrenching experience for me, and I was only a spectator. One moment she was courageous, the next pitifully frail. I was mesmerized. I could not imagine the nightmare she and her family had been through. I wondered, what would I do if she were my daughter? As I watched her suffer before the jury, I wanted personally to shoot the rapist. For one brief yet interminable moment, I wanted to be her father. I wanted justice. There was a story there. And that's the story that you developed into A Time to Kill. Did you think you were capable of that kind of revenge?
At that moment, I sure did. In that courtroom, only a few feet away from the defendant, all of us who were there, I think collectively we felt very capable of inflicting some measure of revenge upon this defendant who had, you know, done things to this little girl that beyond description. But there were moments during her testimony when I was facing the jury, off to the side, and I knew three of the jurors, three out of the 15, and they were all covering their eyes because they were crying, and the judge was also trying to cover his eyes, and the prosecutor, a man I knew well and who could cry instantly, was also crying, and even the defendant's own lawyers were, you know, studying their shoes, and it, you know, was beyond, well, emotion's not an adequate word, but it would, I think it would have been easy right then at that moment to get revenge.
People were crying during the daughter's testimony?
Yeah, little girl's testimony. It was just, you know, she would start crying, and before long, everybody else was covering their faces. And it was, this went on for a couple hours, and the courtroom was locked. The spectators had been excluded by the judge because he knew her testimony would be so graphic and so difficult for her. She was only 12 years old. And it was, you know, we just suffered through it, and I was very anxious to get out of there. I was just a nosy spectator.
Yeah, why were you there in the first place? I mean,
well,
you had your own cases. What interested you?
It was in the early days of my legal career, and at times, if I didn't have a lot to do, I'd go hang around the courtroom, especially if good lawyers were in town trying good cases, because I wanted to be a trial lawyer. And this particular crime had been so heinous and so notorious that we knew when the trial was going to occur, and so I just kind of hung around one day to see what was going to happen. And suddenly there was in the courtroom, and the local lawyers can come and go at will, pretty much, you know, in a courtroom, and we know the judges and all that. And so the judge was not going to exclude me when he closed the courtroom. We took a break after a couple hours of this, and because the little girl just had to have a break, and the judge kept asking her if she wanted a break, and finally she said yes, and so we cleared the courtroom, and everyone was anxious to leave the courtroom, the jury, the judge, and we did. And in my haste to get out of the courtroom, I left behind my briefcase, and I didn't realize it until I was at my car which is downstairs outside, and I realized I had to go back in the courtroom to get my briefcase. And I walked back through the back entrance of the courthouse, up the back stairs, through a side door, and suddenly there I was in the courtroom, and no one had stopped me, and I walked right by the defendant, who was sitting in a chair with a deputy a few feet away, the only two people in the courtroom. And it dawned on me how easy it would be to, get to the man who did that to my child. And it just floored me to think that I could have done it. And that's when the story was born.
This is an interesting thing about your position as a lawyer or a former lawyer and a novelist. As a lawyer, is your position to uphold the law. As the novelist, you're always creating characters who break it.
Yeah, and I'm troubled by that. I think I'll always be troubled by the story of A Time to Kill because it condones vigilantism and that type of justice. And, we cannot function as a society if the victims of crimes are allowed to seek their own remedies. And I don't know if I would write that story again.
John Grisham is my guest. In that first novel, A Time to Kill, you describe the lawyer Jake Brigance as he was clean-cut, conservative, a devout Presbyterian with a pretty wife who wanted babies. How close does that come to describing what you were like when you started your law career?
Pretty close. Again, there's a lot of autobiography. I'm not sure my wife wanted babies when we had them, but it was a joint effort. Small town, struggling lawyer, working hard, trying to get a break, trying to get a big case, trying to get a reputation in a town that's, filled with lawyers.
Clean cut, conservative?
Maybe not that conservative, maybe more of a politically moderate, Baptist, not Presbyterian, few differences. Clean cut, I guess, yeah.
What were your typical cases? If there's such a thing as typical cases.
In the early days, the first 3 or 4 years of my law practice, I did a lot of criminal work, court-appointed criminal work for indigent clients who could not afford attorneys. Back then in our local county, we didn't have a full-time public defender, so the criminal cases were assigned on a rotating basis to the younger lawyers. The older lawyers, of course, had to do it when they were younger, so it was an unwritten rule that the guys fresh out of law school would take the indigent cases, and I did a lot of those. The first year, I'd been out of law school less than a year when I had my first murder trial, which I was not equipped to handle. And then there was another murder trial shortly after that. And so I jumped into a lot of high-pressure courtroom work fresh out of law school. And that was fine with me because I wanted to do that kind of work. And I hoped to sort of gain the courtroom experience, become a good trial lawyer, as fast as possible, and later try more lucrative civil cases. And that's kind of what happened.
Did you feel guilty representing clients in cases that you felt you were not ready to really take on yet?
I would have felt guilty if we lost them, but I won both the murder cases with mm-hmm. not guilty verdicts, and that does a lot for your confidence.
Yeah, I can imagine. And did you always truly believe in the innocence of the people you were defending, or did you have to be in the position sometimes of defending people who you really thought were guilty?
Both the murder cases involved some very strong defenses of self-defense. These were shootings, and the question was who shot first. And my client did, in fact, kill the deceased, but the deceased in both cases were heavily armed. And, again, it's a question of self-defense. There were some cases I wouldn't take. I would never have defended a rapist or a child molester. I simply, refused to do that. I represented a lot of people who were very guilty, and I never had any moral problems doing that. Lawyers can't worry about such things. Under our, you know, judicial and constitutional system, everybody's entitled to an attorney. And regardless of what you're charged with, you're entitled to legal representation. Somebody has to do it.
Did you usually leave cases feeling good about the law or feeling like you were let down by the results?
Most of the time, the system works. Most of the time, juries do what's right. Most of the time, settlements are fair. They're negotiated by both sides. And so the vast majority of the time when I closed a file, I was happy with what had been done. The clients were somewhat satisfied. And it was time to close the file and move on.
My guest is John Grisham. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Grisham has a new legal thriller called The Summons. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with him. Are there many cases in your novels that actually come from cases that you or colleagues close to you took on, or do you mostly invent things and make them a little bit larger than life?
Oh, much larger than life.
Right.
Just,
okay.
This is fiction, okay?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just outright fabrication.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't... I'm sure real live lawyers and real life cases sort of seep into the novels, but I don't build stories around them. I'm much more interested in creating something that's brand new, you know, a big trial against the insurance industry and the Rainmaker, or the trial against the tobacco industry and the runaway jury, or you know, I'd rather paint a larger canvas and maybe call some of my personal experiences occasionally, you know, as minor subplots. I don't really want to write about real people.
Why not?
Even fictionalized versions. Well, I don't want to get sued for one thing.
Oh, yeah, sure. But I mean, real kind of people. Do you want to...
Well, I think a lot of my lawyers are stereotypes of or combinations of real people. I mean, you know, I study lawyers. I watch lawyers. I did when I was an attorney. I'd watch the good trial lawyers, and I spend a lot of time now watching lawyers, keeping up with legal developments, watching or keeping up with trials. And so, sure, I mean, most of my characters are compilations of, you know, real lawyers.
Do you go to the courthouse a lot now, or do you stay home and watch court TV?
Neither. I deplore the idea of televised trials. I always thought there was some sanctity in a very dignified courtroom where people could go and discuss things they would never discuss outside their own homes because they had to. They had to testify. But court TV has made a mockery of all that, and it's turned the actors and judges into, you know, media celebrities and actors. I don't really hang around courtrooms because... For the most part, it's very boring stuff. And I can't think of anything worse than watching a long trial. But I follow trials. You know, it's you can get the daily summaries in the papers. And I'm always, you know, watching issues and trying to piece together stories from current issues.
Was it interesting for you to watch how some people deal with pressure, how some people break and other people... are able to manage during a trial?
Yeah, trial work is very stressful. It's high-powered, you know, high stakes, tons of pressure. And I've seen lawyers crack up in long trials. Others seem to thrive on the combat in the courtroom.
What about you? How'd you do?
I didn't really enjoy it. I mean, I thought I wanted to be a trial lawyer, but honestly, I never had any fun in the courtroom. I never enjoyed myself, even when I was winning. You don't win until it's all over, so you can't, you know, you worry about defeat up until the very end. But I had trials against lawyers who just seemed to love the sport and the pressure of the courtroom. And I was never that way. I never was able to relax. I'd lose sleep. You know, long trial, you don't eat much, you don't sleep much. A lot of lawyers turn to alcohol because of that, because it is high pressure. And I knew a lot of those guys. But I didn't handle the pressure very well.
What about the competition in the games opposing lawyers play with each other, trying to psych each other out? Did that trouble you too?
Yeah, it really does, because especially if, you know, the opposing lawyer was from a very large firm, and it seemed like he always was, because I was a sole practitioner. I was what we called ourselves street lawyers, because we were representing people out on the streets, people who were injured or wronged or fired or whatever. And typically we're always suing insurance companies and big defendants, and they hire big lawyers and big firms, and they all come in packs and dress alike and, you know, have fancy degrees, and they just descend on the courtroom, and it can be very intimidating. And I always wanted to be one of those plaintiff's lawyers who could take on, you know, a small army of defense lawyers and do so successfully. I never made it, but there could be a lot of intimidation, and there was a lot of intimidation imposed on a young lawyer struggling to keep up with the big boys.
What year did you start writing your first novel?
Started in November of 84, same year I took office in the legislature.
Busy man. You were still practicing law, too?
Oh, yeah. That was what I was doing for a living. I mean, the legislature didn't pay hardly anything. The book writing was still a, you know, distant dream. And the only way I could write was to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go to the office and write for an hour or two before the day started. And I did that over a period of, well, I got in the habit of doing it, and over a period of 3 years, the first book was completed, and it became so ingrained that when I finished A Time to Kill, I think virtually the next day I started writing the next book, which was The Firm.
When you were writing A Time to Kill and going to the office at 5:30 every morning, was that your home office or your legal office?
Oh, that was my legal office. It was about 5 minutes from my house. And it was on the main drag of our main street of our little town of 25,000, which is a suburb of Memphis, just outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And so I would be there at 5:30 in the morning. I'd turn on all the lights so everybody driving by to work would be able to see that I was there, you know, at 5:30 in the morning.
Why, so you'd look industrious?
Yeah, you know, I got the reputation as a real hard-working young lawyer, you know.
Little did they know you weren't working on anybody's case.
I was up there trying to finish a book. And it was kind of funny, after The Time to Kill came out and I told the story, I had clients who said, so that's why my file never got taken care of. We were up there trying to write a novel.
So nobody knew you were really writing a novel?
Nobody but my wife. Nobody. I didn't tell anybody until the book was finished. Renee read each chapter as I wrote it, but she was the only one. I mean, I wasn't about to tell anybody. And it took 3 years, and at least for 2 years, the first 2 years, I was not even sure I was going to finish it. I mean, there was really nothing to talk about. And I remember one day realizing that the story was half through, and at some point in there, I was determined to go ahead and finish it, but there was a lot of doubt. I think I went 4 weeks one time without working on it, and there were many times when I didn't want to work on it. It was just, I mean, I didn't want to get up at 5 in the morning. I wanted to sleep for, you know, another hour or so, and I often wondered now, you know, what would have happened had I quit.
Do you ever wonder why you had this urge then to write before you knew if it was anything in it for you, if you could even complete the book?
Well, I wanted to see if I could do it. I wanted to get it typed and have this big stack of pages and then try to get it published. And once I realized I was going to finish it, then I began having all these wonderful dreams about getting it published. And once you start thinking about getting published, you start thinking about bestsellers and movies and all that stuff. And it's a whole lot of fun to dream about that. And I got caught up in that. Now, that prompted me to finish the book and to write the next one and to start thinking about, just the dream of a big book and lots of money.
You said, how did the dream compare to the reality?
You can only dream so much. The reality is far in excess of anything I ever dreamed back then. It is an enormous amount of fun to be able to write for a living and to have the books, you know, well-received by a lot of folks, and it's still a dream.
John Grisham, I thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
John Grisham recorded in 1997. He has a new legal thriller called The Summons. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.